Okay, I would appreciate if somebody could close the back door. We have a back door in this room. It's visible. Okay. It seems the audience is there's quite a lot of people in the audience, quite crowded. I'm surprised. Maybe a short introductory question. How many people in this room do think network address translation is evil? Okay, that's less than 30-40%, I would say. So hopefully, with this presentation, I can convince people that network address translation really is evil and that it causes so many problems numerous problems all over the place. First of all, maybe some background about myself. I'm Harald Wölte. Actually, I'm also doing the audio-video recording, head of the audio-video recording staff of this conference, and we have the light fixed to one location. We have only fixed microphones to sort of nail down the presenters to a specific position. So actually getting them on videotape and getting the lighting is easier than if people start walking around and, you know, this kind of stuff. Anyway, this is sort of cut. Well, anyway, let's go back to the beginning of the slide. Yeah, I'm Harald Wölte. I'm mostly known as one of the maintainers and one of the authors of the Linux kernel packet filtering and network address translation subsystem called Netfilter IP tables. Now you can ask yourself, you know, this somebody sitting in front of you giving a presentation about why network address translation is evil, and he's one of the people who actually implemented it. One of the implementations that's used quite often in Linux operating systems. I didn't do this voluntarily. I didn't do it, you know, because I think network address translation is this great technique, and it's it helps a lot of people, but just because it's somehow necessary, it's a necessary evil, I would say, at the moment. And as said in this presentation, I'm going to talk about what kind of problems we have and how they probably can be addressed and how people try to address them in the last couple of years. So network address translation is basically a very old technique. It's widely used throughout the internet. I'm not telling you anything new here. Sort of believed to be a way to cope with address shortage. I'm not buying into this 100%. I would say it's mostly also a technique to get around arbitrary restrictions of ISPs who try to divide internet users into content providers and into end users. And end users, you know, they are consumers. They get asymmetric bandwidth. They get dynamically assigned IP addresses, and they never get more than one. So. Getting around the address shortage might be one actually reason, but there's more than that. So network address translation is more and more popular these days since a couple of years ago, people had in their home environment, they had like one PC, and the PC used to have a phone line, modem, or ISDN, or whatever, and was hooked up to the network. But these days, people tend to have Ethernet at home, or any kind of wireless, wired Ethernet, any kind of local network, at your parents' place or wherever. You know, regular computer users, not hackers, have networks at home. So we have these kind of embedded devices. Sometimes they're called even only modems or routers or whatever, but usually what you get is like a packet filter, a network address translation, and a router in one kind of box provided by some company. The problem is that network address translation is not really standardized anywhere. And certainly I want to state that network address translation is not a security technique. Lots of vendors still try to convince people who are interested in getting or implementing putting network address translation into a network that this is a security technique, you know, because, oh, yes, your internal addresses are not known to the outside internet, but, this is not a security technique. Network address translation is merely, a way of getting something to work, but it's not a security technology at all. What does network address translation do? Well, just a couple of slides, very, very easy ones. Basically, it's about rewriting addresses in IP packets as they pass a particular forwarding point or a particular point in the network. Initially, this was really only network address translation, which means like layer 3 IP address translation, so you change the IP address in packets and that's it. However, shortly after, people implemented sometimes referred to as NAPT, network address and port translation. And with this, you also translate the port numbers in the packets, so not only the IP addresses, but also the port numbers. And suddenly after that, it was required that you also need to translate stuff in layer 5, what I call layer 5 plus. So you need to translate FTP port statements, stuff like that. So you need application layer gateways that change the contents of the payload of the actual packets. So it's not only address translations, it's address and port and even payload translation, which actually happens. Traditionally, this kind of translation happens at a router, which already forwards packets, but it's also possible on a bridge. So you can actually do network address translation on a bridge, which is totally invisible to, even on layer 2, invisible to your network. There's even implementations that do stuff like MAC address translation. So you can do layer 3, 4, 5 plus translation, even layer 2 translation. And there's commercially available product that implement that. It's not just a hypothetical, theoretical mode of operation, but for example, using the Linux 2.6 kernel, you can do that, and there's even commercial products which use Linux 2.6 to implement network address translation on a layer 2 level. So now we have some kind of definition what network address translation is. We have a number of modes of operation that people tend to use when they use network address translation. Most commonly known is the source network address translation case, where the first packet of a particular, the source address of the first packet of a particular connection is changed. So I'm only looking here at the first packet of a connection in order to get some kind of direction connections are always both ways, but I say the direction of a connection is always defined by the first packet of a connection. And now you can say, what about UDP? What about other protocols? Then if you talk about DNS, for example, then the first packet sort of establishes the UDP connection, and the reply packet, is a reply to the original packet. So when I talk about directions, I'm always talking about the first packet of a particular connection or a session or whatever you might call it. So SourceNet is translation of the source address of the first packet. Masquerading is basically the same thing. It's just a special case of SourceNet and most commonly used in this kind of consumer setup where you have dynamically assigned or even statically assigned, but you only have a single address and you want to translate to that address. There's also destination network address translation, which is sometimes referred to as port mapping or port redirection or port binding or whatever kind of terms people come up with, which is basically the reverse way. So a packet comes in and you change destination address of the original packet in order to, for example, you have your single IP address on your NAT gateway and you want to redirect some connections onto other machines in your network, then you have this kind of port mapping, port redirection, or I call it destination network address translation operation. There's also the combination of both of them, which means BINET. I think BINET is something, a term that was formed by the IP filter implementation. Other implementations call it different, but the idea is that you have a one-by-one translation between networks. So let's say you have a slash 24 network on the left-hand side of your router and you have a slash 24 on the right-hand side, and you want to translate one-by-one addresses. Or let's say you have an internal network, but there's a slash 24, and you use internal addresses in there, and then you have an official addresses, and your network address translator assigns one static external address to every internal address that you have, and it works both ways. That's what people call BINAT, bidirectional network address translation, also sometimes referred to as network mapping. So why is network address translation a nightmare? It might have been sort of a solution or a kludge for a problem that came up at some point in the internet. But one of the fundamental problems with network address translation is that it is designed around the traditional client-server paradigm that used to dominate network protocols over the last, you know, decades or so. The internet gets more and more advanced applications every year. We have seen quite a lot of peer-to-peer networks in the last couple of years. We've seen some voice over IP deployment, although not to the extent that it would be possible, and that's where network address translation becomes an important issue, and all kinds of multimedia streaming applications, which can also be, video telephony, these kind of applications. Because of these new applications, we see that the protocols used by these applications get more complex as well. So we have multiple layer 4 connections comprising one logical connection or one logical session. If you look at H323, for example, or at SIP-based voice over IP telephony, then you have a number of, from a networking point of view, separate connections that comprise a single call that you do in voice over IP terminology. So you have, for example, the SIP connection, which can be UDP or TCP, and then you have RTP connections for audio, RTP connection for video, and you have RTCP connections relating to the respective RTP sessions. And you have this tree of, let's say, like five connections from a network point of view that actually resemble a single call. And that's what gets really difficult to handle in network address translation devices. I'm going to show this in the next couple of slides. Those kinds of, as I said, the protocols become more complex. And because they become more complex, you happen to embed layer 3 and layer 4 network addresses, that is IP addresses, port numbers, in the payload of connections. We already have seen that in FTP for, I don't know how many years, I don't know how old FTP is, you know, like 20 years or something. Where you, in the payload of the actual connection, you have addresses, IP addresses, port numbers, stuff like that. And obviously this requires some special handling within the network address translation devices or within the protocol or any component of the protocol. We also have the problem that because we are shifting away from traditional client-server kind of protocols where you send an HTTP request, you get some reply, or you this kind of mode of operation, you establish an SMTP connection to somebody, to a server. That's where network address translation, in the way we've seen it over the last years, works quite well. You have a client machine that sits behind a network address translation device, and you have some servers that are not behind network address translation. But if you look at peer-to-peer networks or at voice over IP, we have suddenly a setup where a client behind one network address translator wants to talk to another client that is behind another network address translator. And you have the problem of how to talk through the network address translation machines in this kind of setup. So this direct client-to-client, in quote, or peer-to-peer transmission of media streams or whatever kind of data is in general not possible due to the deployment of NAT. You might now say, well, I have my network address translator at home, but it works. Well, yes, it works because, you know, lots of people put clutches on top of clutches on top of clutches on top of hacks in order to make it work with your particular device, but it's not a generic way of there's no single generic way of making this kind of protocol work across all kind of network address translation implementations because there is no standardization. And that's, from my point of view, mostly a lack of the IETF, but I'm going to talk about that later. Some background on why it, even like 8 years ago, whenever network address translation became an issue in the network, it was, well, sort of a solution or a clutch, but even at that point, it didn't really work for all cases. We didn't have peer-to-peer then, we didn't have voice over IP, but it still had, or it already had problems at that point. So I'm just going to give you a short overview of what is necessary to make FTP work over a network address translator, and hopefully you will understand why this isn't really a thing that you want to do. So first of all, you change IP and port numbers of the control connection. So FTP, I assume that everybody's familiar with the mode of operation of the FTP protocol. So you establish a control session from your FTP client to the FTP server. And, your client establishes that connection. The initial packet, as soon as it goes through the network address translation device, the source address is rewritten, the port number is rewritten. Then it comes to the server, and you start talking to the server. You authenticate yourself. You do whatever kind of stuff, and then you want to transfer a file or transfer directory listing, whatever. Your FTP client sends a port command that is like the one I've written there. So it's something like first octet of IP address, comma second octet, comma third octet, comma fourth octet, comma first octet of port number, comma second octet of port number. So you split the 16-bit port number into 8-bit pieces, and you have the dotted quad notation of IP addresses as dotted comma notation. This is represented in ASCII. That's important to note. So your FTP network address translation application layer gateway that you have in your network address translator needs to rewrite that into the real address that you have on the internet. And now let's assume for a second that your internal address was the 123, 123, 123, 123. Now it gets rewritten into 1.1.1.1. And as you can see on the slide, even though it doesn't use a fixed width font, the length of the string is different, because in the initial port command you had three-digit numbers, now you have single-digit numbers. So the string is shorter. Now you rewrite that data in the TCP control connection, and suddenly your string is shorter, which means that the packet will be shorter that you send. And if the packet you send is shorter, then the sequence numbers suddenly don't match anymore between what the server expects and between what the client expects. So you start rewriting from this point on, from the point on where you've seen the first port command, you need to rewrite every sequence number and every acknowledgement number in both directions of this connection, because the server has different expectations than the client of sequence numbers. Now think of a single FTP control session establishing multiple data connections successively. So you have something like port command, couple of bytes, next port command. And when this happens within a single TCP window, you cannot be sure that the port commands that your client sent to the server have already arrived. They are not acknowledged yet. They are in the window. So the server can, some packets can get lost, and the server can ask for retransmissions. And now you need to see which particular sequence number the server wants you to retransmit, and whether this was before the first command, between the two port commands, or after the second port command. Because depending on the place within the connection, you have different offsets that you need to subtract or add to the sequence numbers. And this gets even more interesting when you think about retransmissions, for example. When you think about selective acknowledgments. TCP has this nice feature of having selective acknowledgments. So you have this special TCP options that indicate, I acknowledge from this sequence, from sequence number 10 to 20 and from 30 to 40, and then you need to mangle all these selective acknowledgement options in the TCP header and so on. Yeah, it is a nightmare too. And it's ugly as hell. It is quite a lot of state that you need to keep at the network address translator. It is hard to get right. Actually, I've seen a lot of broken implementations. Even our network traffic tables implementation was broken up to some point, where initially we didn't want to deal with the selective acknowledgement case, so we just said, when the control connection is established, we remove... selective acknowledgement is an optional feature that is negotiated at connection startup time. So we remove the option when the connection is set up. So selective acknowledgement would never be negotiated between the two ends. But we just zeroed it out. And zero in TCP options is not a no operation, but it's end of options. So if you had any TCP options after the selective acknowledgement options, they would be ignored during the connection setup. There's lots of embedded devices somewhere in the network, whether some obscure operating system or some old version of Linux or BSD or whatever kind of software, including network address translation, and they all tend to behave differently. Sometimes they don't cut the packet, but they fill in blanks, and some FTP servers don't deal with if you have additional blanks at that point. there's lots of security implications when you know, somebody sends you wrong port commands. If you don't check whether the IP address is really the same IP address that than the one that was originally used, people could drill holes or open port mappings or whatever you might want to call them into your device and so on and so on. So even FTP is already a problem. I'm not going to talk about H.323 at that point, where you have to have an ASN1 parser built into your application layer gateway, because you need to parse the ASN1 encoding that is in the H.323 session in order to find out at which particular place the IP address is placed. If you go further for SIP, the SIP IP telephony session initiation protocol, it was even more ugly than that, because it cannot even only contain IP addresses in the payload of the control connection, but there can be host names. And then your network address translator would have to start DNS resolving these host names or do reverse lookups and hold the packets up to this point. And, you know, it's just like, it's a nightmare. It is. Another issue is that the network address translator have to violate the network layering model. I mean, there's a reason why networks are layered. You have physical layer, layer two, you have network layer, IP, you have TCP, and all these protocols layered on top of each other. But network address translator have to violate them because they need to do ugly things like changing port commands inside TCP connections, stuff like that. This also means that they need knowledge about your upper layer application protocols. For network address translation box to work, it's not sufficient that it knows how TCP works and how IP works and how to deal with these protocols, but it needs to know specifically about FTP, specifically about SIP, specifically about H.323. And every time somebody designs a new protocol, you need to have some explicit support in the NAT devices, which means that you're fighting with millions of installed NAT boxes which are already deployed, which cannot be updated, or which users don't update, or where the vendors are gone, or the vendors don't care about providing updates, and so on. So basically, you lose any kind of future compatibility for new upcoming protocols in the net. And also, you lose the ability to reasonably encrypt payload, like in the SIP case. Session initiation protocol has a specification in RFC where you can actually PGP encrypt the SDP payload that is in the SIP protocol. So you have the session description protocol, which can be PGP encrypted, and then you put this in SIP, in the session initiation protocol. And if you encrypt that, the network address translation device has no idea what kind of IP addresses or port numbers are negotiated within the encrypted payload. So you just cannot make it work. It's impossible. Either you encrypt or you make it work with network address translator, but you cannot do both. It's impossible. Because this problem was so fundamental, this was actually the first time within, you know, I don't know how many years, that the IETF thought about that. I'm going to get back to this issue later. So the IETF became aware, oh, yes, there is a problem with network address translation and voice over IP. And they started working groups. And the working groups started to think for 3 years, and they came up with no working solution. So let's try to classify behavior of network address translation devices in certain ways. One first assumption to define abstract classes of network address translation implementations was done in RFC 3489, where this is ESTAN, it's sort of a traversal for certain kinds of network address translator that were believed to be common, but which turned out to be not that common at all in the internet. So anyway, it tries to define behavior of network address translators. As I said, there is a number of different ways how you can implement a network address translation. And the behavior can be classified in multiple ways. Next couple of slides are just about how to find terms or definitions or names for particular aspects of network address translators. As I said, ESTAN RFC was about the first one who tried to formalize this kind of behavioral classification. The first definition they make is what they call a full cone NAT, which means that all requests from the same internal IP address and port number are mapped to the same external IP address and port number. And any external host can send a packet back to the internal host by sending a packet to that mapped address. So this is the most primitive implementation of a network address translation implementation. So you send a packet out from your client. You get a particular port binding, so to say, at the network address translator. And whoever on the internet sends you a packet to that particular port number on your external IP, that packet gets fed back into your client in the internal network. That's the most primitive way of operation. But then, this is quite open. So as soon as you send a packet out to the internet, everybody will be able to send packets back. That's why I say it's not a security technology or something like that. If you have some additional security technology like a stateful firewall, this of course is more restricted. But that's we're talking about network address translation right now. Then what they have another definition, what they call restricted cone. So it's basically like the full cone with the change that the reply, or you have the internal machine that sends out a packet to the internet, and some other machine replies to that packet. This some other machine has to be a machine that you have sent a packet before. So it's a little bit more restrictive than the full cone. You don't accept any kind of incoming packet to that port, but just an incoming packet from a machine that you've been talking to before. That's restricted cone. Then we have what they call port restricted cone, which is the same as a restricted cone, but also taking into account the port number. So when you send a packet from, let's say, host A, port number P, that gets translated to host T, port number P, and the destination is host D, port number X, then the packet comes back. It is only accepted or only translated backwards to the client if it comes from a port address and IP address that you've sent a packet to before. So it's more restrictive. It's a port restricted cone. And then there's what the IETF calls fully symmetric network address translation, which means that the full 5-element tuple is the unique criteria, which means that source IP address, destination IP address, source port number, destination IP address, and layer 4 protocol number have to be the same for anybody to send back a packet to the machine that is behind the network address translator. This is the most, how can I say, beautiful and perfect, if such a thing exists, for a network's translator to implement. That's why we are doing this in the NetFilter project, by the way. But anyway, it turns out that this is obviously, because it's the most restrictive one, the one which is the hardest to get right for any kind of peer-to-peer or other kind of new application, because it's so restrictive. That's the kind of category. So why it is important to differentiate between those different classes of network address translators or behavior of network address translators? You need to somehow have a way to give name to certain behavioral principles of the network address translators in order to say that this kind of protocol design would work over, port restricted cone and symmetric NAT, but not about this kind of NAT. So you need to classify it somehow in order to say which kind of protocol would work in which kind of way. Then it turned out that these four classes of the S-Town RFC are not enough. There is a draft, it's called Draft OD NAT Behave. It's the so-called Behave working group. It's now an official working group of the IETF. I'm participating in that working group. They found that there is like 6 or 7 different dimensions of classification of network address translation behavior that you need to take into account if you want to make a decision whether something would work over this particular network address translator or not. One of them is address and port binding, which they call endpoint independent, address dependent, and address and port dependent, which is sort of what S-TUN did before. The S-TUN 4 classes is maps onto these three classes. And then there is an interesting criteria, the so-called port assignment criteria, which means that I'm a client behind a NAT, I'm establishing a connection. Which kind of new source port number will the network address translation device choose? That's what we're talking about with port assignment. There are network address translation implementation which have a feature called port preservation, which means that if I'm sending a packet from source port 20, then the network address translation device will try very hard to leave the port number the same as it was. So if the port number 20 within the given hash tables and whatever is unique, then your port will be port number will be preserved. The idea is that there are certain old protocols like TFTP and DNS zone transfer, stuff like that, that actually match on source port numbers. So if you some DNS implementation, if you get a zone transfer from a port number that is not 53, it will fail. So the network address translator tries to have port persistency and not change the source port number unless it's absolutely required. And then there's something beyond that, which they call port overloading, which is if you have multiple connect, like you have one client behind your network address translator, and it makes, let's say, one SSH connection to host A on the internet, and he makes another SSH connection on host B, or even two clients that have each a single SSH connection to different hosts on the internet, and they, for example, they both just booted up and they both use port 1024 as their source port because that's the first port number a system uses after boot up. Both connections will still preserve the original port number. So just by looking at the port number, you don't have a unique criteria anymore. But the port number gets overloaded, and when you receive reply packets, by looking at the source address of the reply packet, you can determine which particular connection the packet belongs to. That's what they call port overloading, which is port preservation plus plus, so to speak. So then you have another criteria, which they call the bind refresh scope, which means, network address translation, the way we're talking about, is dynamic. So whenever you establish a connection, you will get some kind of mapping, either with port preservation or port overloading or with a totally different port. But it's a dynamic thing. And the question is, when does this kind of mapping that the network address translator create expire? Because it cannot live indefinitely. Otherwise, you would run out of port numbers, addresses, whatever kind of stuff. So the question is, when does it get refreshed? That's usually a timer that expires this kind of binding information. And when does it get refreshed? Is it only refreshed when you see incoming packets for a particular session? Is it only refreshed when you see outgoing packets? Is it refreshed if you see traffic in both directions? Is it refreshed if you see traffic for a particular connection or traffic for a particular host, for example? That's per session, per binding kind of refresh. And all these things you need to take into consideration. I'm not talking about this for fun, but because you need to take this into consideration if you want to make anything work about network address translators. Let's say you have a streaming media application, that just sends you a packet and it uses UDP over its underlying, or it uses UDP as its underlying transport protocol, and you receive packets. Somehow manage to establish a connection, and then you just receive incoming UDP packets for a particular port mapping in your network address translator. And if only incoming packets don't refresh the network address translation binding, it will expire after whatever kind of expiry time your implementation uses, and you will cease to receive that stream. So to make a protocol work over these kind of devices, you need to send some kind of keep-alive packets in the opposite direction from client to server that have no other purpose but to not expire the session in a network address translation device. So you start building these kinds of clutches into protocols in order to make it work about across certain kind of devices. More different kind of classes we have. Filtering of unsolicited packets, endpoint independent, address dependent, address and port dependent, is sort of like the S-TUN classification. Then they have a different category, what is called hairpinning behavior. Let's assume you have a kind of peer-to-peer network, and you have two clients who want to do peer-to-peer behind the same network address translator. What do you do? Ideally, a network address translation device would translate the connection twice. So all packets go to the network address translator, and from that go back to the other client into the internal network. So you have this, it's called hairpin behavior, because you know, if you draw a graph or you draw it this way, then it looks like, you know, hairpin, whatever. That's the hairpinning behavior, which is not so much important for your home network, where there are not too many users usually, and you know, if you don't want to do file sharing, you have an SMB or NFS mount or something like that. But it's more important for larger installations. And in Germany, I haven't heard about that so far, but I've heard from countries where usually when you get IP access, you're already behind network address translation. It's like even your ISP doesn't give you any officially routed address, but you're already behind that. And then, of course, it gets more interesting how this hairpinning behavior is. Then there's lots of properties that can be deterministic or not. There is network address translation devices or implementations that have behavior that changes over time. So if you, for example, you have a very intelligent protocol or a very intelligent application that tries to probe which kind of network address translator we are trying to communicate through and define, you know, like, oh, do we have hairpinning or not? What kind of, do we have full cone or restricted cone, port restricted cone, symmetric? Now, you can probe all these kind of behavior with certain packets and you can find out what kind of device you have. But when the device behavior changes over time, the probing doesn't help you, because when you probe, you feel, oh yes, this device has port preservation, but then when you establish your real connection, it doesn't have port preservation anymore, because there was some condition in the network address translation device that made it change its algorithm for selecting port numbers, stuff like that. So even the probing doesn't help you at that point. And there are people analyzing network address translators. Like, there's even a draft, it's called the draft S-TAN results, where a couple of people just went to Fry's in the US and bought all the embedded routers, gateways, access points, whatever kind of devices that implement NAT they had. You know, they just had this huge amount of you know, Linksys, Belkin, whatever kind of products. And then they probed them for their network address translation behavior. And they found lots of devices that actually have non-deterministic behavior that changes over time. And especially if you want to do stuff like port preservation or port overloading, it has to change. Because as soon as a particular port number or a particular mapping is already used by one connection and you have another connection that would clash with the original connection, you have to change the port suddenly. So first you try to preserve it, and if you cannot preserve it, you change it. So sometimes you change, sometimes you prefer you preserve. So how can you design a protocol to take that into consideration? Another issue is that multicast behavior. There are actually network address translators that implement multicast network address translation, which is also an interesting problem in itself, but I'm going to go to the next slide. So the IETF has ignored network address translation for a very long time, and they have ignored the fact that they are commonplace all over the network. Because they said, well, you just don't do it. You see, like, we know there are people who use network address translators, but we don't use them. You know, just don't use. The solution is don't use them. So, you know, this is the kind of attitude that was there. And this only changed very recently, like a year ago, where at some IETF meeting, I've just read the notes. I wasn't there, but from reading the notes, somebody was asking the audience, you know, like, who is not behind a network address translator? And there was nobody, you know. And then suddenly they realized they need to take care of dealing with network address translation. As I said, because it was ignored so long, there is no standardization. There's a couple of very old RFCs that, you know, just tell you what is obvious from today's perspective. But they don't tell you, you know, what kind of minimum timeouts for refreshing you should use, or what kind of port preservation behavior you should use when you implement network address translation, this kind of thing. So you just do whatever you think, and then you end up with the inconsistent behavior which we have right now. So also another issue is that protocol designers regularly, still today, don't take into consideration that network address translation is, you know, all over the network. Look at, for example, IPsec, well, IPsec is quite old, but anyway, if you look at IPsec, it doesn't really work with network address translation. Then at a later point, they issued some clutch where you encapsulate ESP packets into UDP, which they call NAT traversal. So they did some modifications to a protocol. This RTP, for example, RTP, the real-time transfer protocol, which is used for any kind of, or almost any kind of streaming and even for voice over IP in the SIP case. And the designers of the protocol define some very peculiar thing that doesn't exist in any other protocol, which is like RTP port numbers always have to be even. They're not allowed to be odd. And the RTCP connection always have to be the RTP port number minus one. So unless your network address translator knows about those strange rules and knows that those rules only apply for RTP, and RTP doesn't operate on well-known port numbers. So again, you need to do parsing of the protocol payload in order to know, oh, this looks like an RTP session, and I'm not allowed to map that onto an odd port number. And it's like, what is this? So even, as I said, protocol designers tend to not take it into consideration. And it's like, I don't know where they live or where they've been in the last 10 years. So also, it is, if you want to take it into consideration, it's impossible to design any kind of more complex protocol that works across all the existing network address translators, or even like 90% of them. They tried it with S-TAN, and they failed. And they mostly failed because of Linux. I'm not proud of that, but they didn't look at, you know, some people in the IETF met, and it was like Cisco and Nortel, and they said, oh, yes, we have 90% of the vendors in this room, and all their solutions would work. But what they didn't actually take into consideration is that it's not about vendors, it's about implementers. You know, if you look at the Linksys boxes, which people buy everywhere in Belkin, and all these embedded devices, I would say 50, 60% of them use Linux. And you don't care whether the device is from Netgear or from Belkin, or if you have a representative from Netgear or from Belkin. You care about what kind of implementation is used in there. You don't care what the company name is. So because the Linux network address translation is a fully symmetric NAT, and S-TAN doesn't work with fully symmetric NAT, but only solves the problems for all other kinds of NAT, you see. So with SIP, the IETF recognized that they had serious issues. So the SIP working group came up with a protocol called FCP, the Firewall Control Protocol. There's even two free implementations of this protocol for Linux. However, they didn't really, you know, it didn't come to an RFC or something like that. So they just, you know, played a bit, and then it was, due to mysterious reasons, it was dropped. And they founded a new working group because they said, oh, well, so their idea of how to deal with network address translation was not to specify how the translation should work or how a protocol should look like to work over the translation. They thought, well, we define a protocol how a client can talk to the network address translator and tell the network address translator what kind of, you know, mappings or whatever it should establish. That's one of the three classes of solutions you can find for the problem. And then they thought, well, this is a sort of a generic problem of some machine trying to control some router or other box that is in the packet forwarding path. And they thought, oh, yes, let's call those boxes middle boxes. And because they're called middle boxes, we found a working group that is called middle box communication. And the middle box communication working group was discussing for 3 years how to develop or how to make a standardized generic protocol that can talk to any kind of middle box and, you know, configure it in any possible way. In the end, they published, I think, 4 or 5 RFCs or draft documents, whatever. But none of them really specified what you wanted to do. So there's dozens of groups that publish papers, drafts, and RFCs. Most of them are targeted for UDP-only applications because people, you know, everybody... Apparently, the most exciting thing people can do over the internet is making telephone calls these days. So everybody only cares about voice over IP because this is enormous market and this huge whatever, blah, blah, blah. And they only target the consumer and network address translation devices, those kinds of standards and papers and whatever they had. How can we solve the problems? There's three different ways. We can do it at a, well, the third way seems to, I don't know what's with the presentation. Anyway, you can solve it at a protocol level. So you can, or you can try to solve it at a protocol level. You can try to design a protocol to operate over network address translations. As I said, SIP has, for example, added some later extensions. IPsec introduced the net traversal mechanism. But it's very difficult because of the number of different implementations and the lack of standardization. You can address the problem or try to address the problem at a network address translation device or implementation level and design your device in a way that it allows what they call hole punching for UDP, and there's now even some ideas about hole punching for UDP, which is basically a technique required to make peer-to-peer sessions through multiple layers or hierarchies of network address translators work reliably. But the problem is that you have a large deployment of already existing boxes, and you just cannot change all these existing boxes. I mean, yes, they are becoming more cheap, and you know, it's most of them die after 2 years because the, you know, whatever kind of electrolytic capacitors in the cheap devices go, you know, broken and whatever. But anyway, you have a large deployment, and it will not work with this existing deployment. So you have a chicken and egg problem. You can do it with a specific network address translation configuration protocol, which is what the firewall control protocol, the MIDCOM working group is about, and the GIMP's ENSYS NAT NSLP is about, which is one of the interesting acronyms that the IETF comes up with, which is the generic internet messaging protocol, something, next steps in signaling network address translation, NAT signaling layer protocol or something like that. So you can, I cannot memorize all these acronyms. And Microsoft did some very clumsy attempt with UPnP as well. They call it Universal Plug and Play. And it's basically a non-authenticated way where every worm on your desktop can open arbitrary holes in your firewall. It is, universal way of having fun with your network address translator. There is the RFC 3489 STUN, which helps. So the idea is that you have one machine on the internet that is known, or at least one machine, that is known to be not behind network address translation. And every client or every node that wants to make any kind of peer-to-peer connection setup first talks to this node known not to be behind NAT, and it sends back and forth a couple of probing packets, and then you basically know, are you port restricted, cone, full cone, whatever kind of network address translator. So this is kind of probing mechanism which I was talking about to determine the behavior of network address translator. And the idea is that applications can open ports and do this UDP hole punching technique and make it work. It's implemented with a lot of applications, especially HTTP/3 applications like GNOME Meeting, for example. However, as I said, it doesn't work with a lot of devices because it doesn't work on fully symmetric NATs. And there's no way it could work on fully symmetric NATs. Also, we have another issue, which is, just skipping over the slide very quickly, the Internet Architecture Board made a problem statement about the increasing use of gaming protocols, voice over IP, and streaming media over UDP, which doesn't have congestion control, and they fear that at some point we might see an event called congestion collapse in certain areas of the net. So they are developing new layer 4 protocols that should be used instead of UDP to prevent that congestion collapse from happening, which means we need new layer 4 protocol support in network address translators, which again will not work with the existing devices, obviously. As I said, you make yourself future incompatible with network address translators. Yeah, that's the next steps in signaling working group, which first developed a signaling transport protocol for signaling quality of service network address translation and firewalls. Then there's the generic internet messaging protocol for signaling, which can be used on top of TCP, UDP, HTTP, or DCCP. DCCP is the datagram congestion control protocol, which is one of the protocols the IETF develops in order to avoid the congestion collapse resulting from using UDP without congestion control. It can be combined with transport layer security or with IPsec. You see, this is, you know, secure works over any kind of protocol is very generic, and it uses IP protocol, IP messages with router alert options in order to be intercepted at intermediate nodes. And then there is the NAT ANSYS signaling layer protocol, which is sort of the way how to establish connections between two ends over any number of network address translated in the middle. And you can see there's already like five or six drafts that just talk about specific specific like security problems, how to migrate to these, and so on and so on. I think it's easier to just use IPv6. And I was like, so yeah. 7 minutes to go. We have the Behave working group, which is quite sane from my point of view, as opposed to all the other approaches that exist at the moment. They just try to acknowledge that there was a lack of standardization, and they want to provide guidelines for implementing network address translators. So they would tell you, you know, port overloading is discouraged. You need to have minimum refresh timeouts of that amount of seconds. You need to have this kind or that kind of multicast behavior. You have to require, you have to support hairpinning in this or that way. So it's like a checklist of requirements. And then if you implement network address translation, you can say, well, if I fulfill this checklist, I can call it behave compliant. And then somebody can define a protocol which says, well, it works over behave compliant NAT devices. So that's the idea that they're working on. There is one document that goes for UDP only at the moment, because as I said, UDP is the highest need for it because of all the voice over IP stuff. And one thing that I argued for and which seems to be integrated into that document is that if you want to be behave compliant, you do not implement network address translation for IPv6. Okay, that's my usual thanks slide. That's at every end of the presentation. So we have 6 minutes for questions. Please use the microphone if you want to ask questions, as we want to record questions as well as answers.
I just had a quick one about FTP. Well, the way I usually do it, if I want to run an FTP server behind my NATed firewall thing there, is I open up the control port and the data port and then tell my FTP server what IP address to pretend to be on, what external IP address, right?
Oh, yes, you can do that, certainly. I mean, there's multiple ways of making, in a controlled setup where you control the address translator and you only have a single FTP server or something like that, in a very small scope, you can do it for single, or for, you know, particular application, particular setup where you have control of all the devices. You can make it work in these cases, but you can never make it work generically.
Okay. So instead of focusing on helping people be able to configure their... because when you're talking about SIP and when you're talking about peer-to-peer stuff, these are going to be NAT devices, which are, in theory, under people's control. So a lot of good can be done there. And okay, it's not a universal, ideal solution, but you can really make it a lot easier for people if they know how to...
Yeah, well, they are not under your control. It's like you get this black box from whatever company, and you don't have any idea about the technology, the details of the technology, and they don't offer you all the bells and whistles and buttons to make it work the way it is supposed to work, or you want to make it work. So,
okay, I can see how that would be a problem.
Fair enough.
Question.
What about SCTP and NAT?
Well, SCTP, for those who've not heard about it, is the Streaming Control Transfer Protocol. It's another layer 4 protocol that is used for signaling of SS7, phone system messages over the internet. Well, it's hard to implement network address translation for SCTP because SCTP has the notion of one connection between more than two endpoints. So it has something like automatic failover when one of your endpoint dies and stuff like that. So if you really want to support all these modes of operation, I think it's going to be very hard to do network address translation for that. Apart from, if you ignore these special features of SCTP, it's just like UDP or TCP or any kind of, more like TCP actually, because it's, yeah.
So they didn't think about network address translation once more.
No, but I think from their point of view, there's not too much you could, well, that's not too much you could actually think of. As far as I know, there is no implementation for SCTP network address translation. Linux 2.6.9 now has support for SCTP stateful packet filtering, but not for network address translation yet.
Thanks.
Two more questions I think we can take, if there are. Question front row.
What's the solution to the problem? I mean, as you said, we have to live with network address translation, but we're not going to see IPv6 probably not even in 10 years.
Well, I think you're very pessimistic about IPv6. I mean, one of the big things I want to state is, you know, if the transition to IPv6 happens, and it's already happening in certain parts of the network, look at Japan, for example. Don't start with something stupid as network translation at that point. You know, like if we start from the beginning with something reasonable, don't ever try to do network address translation again, because we will run again into the same problems. As for now, there is no, as I said, apart from, I think the IETF Behave working group, once that draft turns into an RFC and vendors start to make their implementations compliant to that Behave RFC, we will have some kind of common foundation, and we will see some future protocols work more reliably over network address translation devices. Another thing I wanted to say, network address translation, dynamic network address translation, is never 100% reliable. It's always a best effort kind of thing. If you want to know why, we can take this offline at some point. But there is no good, perfect, whatever kind of solution. The solution is not to use network address translation.
But this is mostly not an option.
This is not an option because of stupid ISPs forcing their customers in this kind, you know, one IP address, dynamic address, whatever. If you actually look at the number of assigned addresses at RIPE NCC, for example, it's not like we're running out of IPv4 addresses tomorrow. So I think but it's a totally different subject. I really think that since ISPs are suddenly telcos and no more ISPs, and telcos are used to and are happy with a consumer-producer model, they charge a huge amount of money for real internet connectivity, which is symmetric and which has static IP addresses, and they make it cheap for stupid consumers who just want to get content of content providers from the net. And I think there's lots of political or whatever kind of motivation and changes going on. Okay, we're out of time. Thank you.